What do you mean?
What I mean isn't hard to show. Let's divide the questioning and answering between us.
How do you mean this time?
Ask me why, when we call both by one name, virtue, we then again call them by two names, courage and wisdom. I'll tell you the reason. It's because the one, courage, has to do with fear, something even wild animals share in, along with the characters of very young children. A soul can become courageous by nature, without any reasoning at all. But a soul that is wise and possesses nous, apart from reasoning, has never come to be, does not exist now, and never will exist in the future, since that's a different sort of thing altogether.
True.
So as for how these two are different, and are two, you've received that from me in argument. Now give me back, in turn, how they are one and the same. Think of it as though you were the one explaining and showing how four things are one, and then ask the same of me, once you've shown how they're one, to show in turn how they're four. And after that, let's consider whether someone who has adequate knowledge of anything at all, that has both a name and a definition, ought to know only the name, and be ignorant of the definition, or whether it's shameful for someone who truly amounts to something to be ignorant of all such things concerning the very matters that differ most in greatness and beauty.
It certainly seems so.
Is there anything more important for a lawgiver and a guardian of the laws, and for someone who thinks he surpasses everyone in virtue and has carried off the prizes for it, than these very things we're now discussing, courage, moderation, justice, wisdom?
How could there be?
So shouldn't the interpreters, the teachers, the lawgivers, the guardians set over everyone else, in dealing with someone who needs to learn and understand, or someone who needs correction and rebuke for wrongdoing, teach him thoroughly what power vice and virtue have, and make it perfectly plain, so as to be superior to others, rather than have some poet who comes into the city, or some self-styled educator of the young, appear better than the man who has mastered virtue entire. And then, in such a city, where the guardians are not adequate in word and deed alike, having sufficient knowledge about virtue, is it any wonder that this city, being unguarded, suffers what many cities today suffer?
No wonder at all, it seems.
Well then, must we do what we're now describing, or how? Must we make the guardians more precise than the many in virtue, both in word and deed? Or in what way will our city be made to resemble the head and senses of intelligent people, since it possesses this kind of guardianship within itself?
How exactly, stranger, and in what way, do we compare it to such a thing when we speak this way?
Clearly the city itself is like the trunk of the body, while among the guardians, the young ones, those chosen as the most naturally gifted, with sharp perception throughout their whole soul, are stationed as if on the topmost peak, keeping watch all around the whole city. And as sentries hand over their perceptions to memory and report to the elders everything that goes on in the city, while those who are likened to the mind, because they think through many things worthy of note with distinctive excellence, the old men are to deliberate, and using the young as their assistants along with joint counsel, are together to preserve the whole city in this way, working as one. Is this how we should describe it, or in some other way ought it to be set up? Should we have everyone equal, without distinguishing certain ones as raised and educated with greater precision?
But my good sir, that's impossible.
Then we must proceed to some more precise education than what came before.
Perhaps.
And might it turn out that the education we've just now more or less touched on is the very one we need?
Absolutely.
Didn't we say that the finest craftsman and guardian in any field must not only be able to look toward the many, but must press on to know the one, and once he knows it, arrange everything with reference to that, keeping it all in view together?
Correctly said.
Could there be a more precise examination and view of anything at all than the ability to look from the many and dissimilar toward a single form?
Perhaps.
Not perhaps, it truly is so, my good man, There is no clearer method than this for any human being.
Trusting you, stranger, I agree, and let's proceed on this basis in our discussion.
Then it seems we must compel the guardians of our divine constitution to see with precision, first of all, what it is that remains the same running through all four. The thing we say is one within courage, moderation, justice, and wisdom, and which is rightly called by the single name of virtue. This, my friends, if we're willing, we must now grip tightly and not let go, until we've said adequately what it is we must look toward, whether as one, or as a whole, or both, or however its nature really is. Or if this escapes us, do we imagine we'll ever be adequately equipped concerning virtue, when we won't be able to say whether it is many, or four, or one? Certainly not. If we're persuaded by our own counsel, we'll have to devise some other way for this to come to exist among us in the city. But if it seems best to drop the matter altogether, we must look to that too.
By the god of hospitality, stranger, such a thing must certainly not be dropped. You seem to us to be speaking most correctly. But how could one manage to bring this about?
Let's not yet say how we might manage it. Let's first make sure, by agreement among ourselves, whether it must be done at all or not.
But surely it must, if it's possible.
Well then, do we think the same about the beautiful and the good? Must our guardians know only that each of these is many, or also how, and in what way each is one?
It seems more or less necessary that they think through how it is one as well.
And what if they can conceive it, but are unable to demonstrate it in argument?
How could that be? You're describing the condition of a slave.
And what about this? Does the same account hold for all serious matters, that those who are truly to be guardians of the laws must truly know the truth about them, and be capable both of explaining it adequately in speech and of following it in their actions, judging what is done rightly and what is not in accordance with nature?
Of course.
And isn't one of the finest of these matters what concerns the gods, which we worked through so earnestly, namely that they exist, and how great is the power they evidently hold? Knowing this to the extent a human being is able to know it, and forgiving most people in the city for merely following the reputation of the laws, while not permitting this for those who are to share in the guardianship, unless someone has thoroughly worked to gain every possible conviction there is concerning the gods. And that the refusal of such trust should mean that the guardians of the laws never choose, as one of their own, a man who is not divine and has not labored diligently over these matters, nor let him be judged fit for virtue either.
It's only just, as you say, that someone lazy or incapable regarding such things should be kept far from what is noble.
Do we know, then, that there are two things that lead to conviction about the gods, of all we went through earlier?
What are they?
One is what we said about the soul, that it is the eldest and most divine of all things, whose motion, once it has taken on generation, has furnished it with ever-flowing being. The other concerns the orderly movement of the stars and everything else over which Nous, having arranged the whole universe, holds mastery. Whoever looks at these things properly, and not in a shallow or amateurish way, could never grow up so godless as to feel anything but the opposite of what most people expect. Most people think that those who take up such studies, astronomy and the other sciences bound up with it of necessity, become godless, because they've seen how things happen by necessity rather than by the purposeful working of a mind bent on good ends.
Well, how does it actually stand?
Exactly the opposite, as I said, of how it stood when people thought of these bodies as lifeless. Even then people were struck with wonder at them, and those who studied them closely already suspected what is now firmly established, that bodies without soul could never make use of such precise and marvelous calculations unless they possessed mind. Indeed, some in that very age dared to risk saying just this, that it was mind that had ordered everything in the heavens. But those same people, going wrong about the nature of soul, thinking it younger than body when it is in fact older, overturned practically everything, so to speak, and ruined their own case far more than anything else. Because what lay right before their eyes, all the bodies moving through the heavens, appeared to them to be crammed with stones and earth, and a mass of other soulless matter, which they made responsible for the causes of the whole universe. That's what produced, in that period, a great deal of atheism and hostility toward such inquiries, and it's what brought on the poet's mockery, comparing philosophers to useless dogs howling pointlessly, along with other foolish things they said. But now, as I said, everything stands the opposite way.
How so?
No mortal man can ever become a secure and steady worshipper of the gods unless he grasps these two truths now being stated. That soul is the oldest of all things that share in generation and immortal and rules over all bodies. And beyond that, as has been said many times now, he must grasp the mind that has been said to reside among the stars governing all things that exist, along with the necessary studies that come before this, and having seen how these connect with music, put them to use in harmony with the practices and customs of moral life, and be able to give a rational account of everything that admits of one. Whoever isn't capable of acquiring these things, along with the ordinary civic virtues, could scarcely ever become a ruler adequate to the whole city. He'd only ever be fit to serve other rulers. So now, Cleinias and Megalus, we need to consider whether, in addition to all the laws we've gone through, we should add this one as well, that the nocturnal council of the officials shall stand as a legal safeguard for the city's preservation, having shared in the full education we've described. Or how shall we proceed?
My good man, how could we not add it, if we're at all able to manage it, even partway?
Then let's all strive together toward this. As for my part, I would gladly join you as a partner in the effort, and I may perhaps find others to join me too, because of my long experience and considerable reflection on such matters.
Well, stranger, above everything, we must go the way that the god is more or less leading us. But what the right method would be for us to follow, that's what we should discuss and investigate now.
It's no longer possible, Megalus and Cleinias, to legislate about such matters before the council itself has been formed. Only once it exists should it become authoritative over what it must itself legislate. But what actually shapes such people would come about through instruction joined with a great deal of shared association if it's carried out correctly.
How so? What should we say this means?
First of all, presumably, a list would have to be drawn up of those suited by nature for this guardianship, in age, in capacity for learning, in character, and in habits. After that come the things that must be learned, which are neither easy to discover nor easy to learn as another's pupil once they've been discovered. Beyond this, the times and the order in which each subject should be taken up. It would be pointless to set these down in writing, since not even the learners themselves could see that they were learning at the right moment, until each of them had gained genuine knowledge of the subject within his own soul. So, put this way, to call all this unspeakable would not be quite right, yet it's unspoken, in the sense that nothing said in advance would make clear what's actually meant.
Given that this is how things stand, stranger, what then should we do?
What we're saying, my friends, seems to rest on shared and even ground between us, and if we're truly willing to gamble everything on the Constitution as a whole, we must do as the saying goes, throw either triple sixes or triple ones. I'll take that risk together with you by stating and explaining what I've concluded about the education and upbringing we've just been discussing again. The risk, mind you, is no small one, nor comparable to any other. This much, Cleinias, I urge you to take to heart. It will be you who either wins the greatest glory by properly establishing this city of the Magnesians, or whatever name the god gives it, or else you will never escape being thought the bravest man among those who come after. And if this divine council of ours truly comes into being, my dear companions, the city must be handed over to it. None of today's lawgivers, one might say, would dispute that. And what we touched on in speech a little earlier, as if in a dream, sketching some rough image of a shared mind and head, will really come to pass, practically wide awake, if only the men are chosen with precision, trained as they should be, and once trained, settle in the Acropolis of the land, and are made into guardians the likes of which we have never before seen in our lives, guardians of the sort needed for the preservation of virtue.
My dear Cleinias, From everything that's just been said, either we must give up founding the city, or we must not let this stranger go, but by every entreaty and every device make him a partner in the city's founding.
Very true, Megalus, and I will do just that, and you must help me.
I will help.